The race is on. This is the second edition of the F1 podcast from the new home of motorsport coverage. And today's big topic is Ferrari's underachievement. No world championships in 11 seasons and just 29 wins from 215 races is more limping horse than Cavallino Lampante. So is there any reason to expect 2020's high hopes to deliver anything other than frustration? I'm Ed Straw, and helping me to get to the bottom of this question today are the race's assistant editor, Lucy Mawson, and my fellow F1 correspondent, Scott Mitchell. So Lucy, are you ready for your podcast debut?
I absolutely am. Yeah, this is bucket list stuff. Very excited to be here and to talk about our topic today, Ferrari's underachievement.
If this is on the bucket list, you must have worked through a lot of things.
It's just depressing. We're at the depressing tail end of the bucket list that this is...
Nothing wrong with that.
Speaking of depressing tail enders, Ed, I think it's time you introduce me.
Yes, I've got a very special introduction for you because I decided I'd ask you, how's the land of flat pack furniture and meatballs?
Very original. Yeah, it's fine. It's really cold actually at the moment, but I'm fine. I'm quite snug in my nice warm flat in South Stockholm, and I'm delighted actually because just before you started to speak to me, I remembered to turn on my recording device. So we are actually going to record a podcast. I dread to think what would have happened if I'd got half an hour in and realised. I think you'd have been quite disappointed in
me. Well, there's always something to be disappointed in you. That's obviously the voice of Scott Mitchell, for those wondering. He likes Swedish things and is a bit of an expert on Ferrari, so the ideal person. So we've got a super team for this this particular podcast. So let's crack on with it. Scott, Ferrari's failings last year have been talked about in depth. Is there any reason to expect things to change in the coming season to make a really serious title bid possible rather than just sort of flattering to deceive as they've done in recent seasons?
Well, what's the cliche? Is it like the more things change, the more they stay the same?
Reaching for a cliche straight away. Good start.
Yeah, well, exactly. But I think for Ferrari, it's the other way around. I think they're hoping that the more things stay the same, the more the bigger picture will change for them, because there's a lot of stability on the Ferrari side in terms of the team itself. And Mattia Binotto, the team boss, always refers to this idea that they're quite a young team. Obviously, that doesn't mean that they're... Sometimes it might look like they're being run by teenagers, but they're not. They are being run by grown adults. But they're people that have been in their roles for a shorter period of time, shall we say, than the likes of Mercedes. And as you know, Ed, Mercedes is just such an all-conquering team because everyone knows their role really well, and they tend to execute it perfectly across the board. And Ferrari, I guess, putting the right people in the right positions is one thing, giving them time to then act on that is another. So I think one of the big things they're hoping for is that there will be natural improvement just by the fact that when Binotto came in last year as team boss, he was the chief technical officer before, there was this change of culture in Maranello, and it takes time for that sort of stuff to bed in. So if you combine the sort of general improvement that they're aiming for just with a bit more cohesiveness, I think that plus extra emphasis on reliability, changing their processes at the factory and through everything from the design phase to validation to implementation on the racetrack to improve that, giving the car more aerodynamic performance and being sharper as a race team. That is what they're hoping will sort of come together to be this package that will finally topple Mercedes.
It's a good point when it comes to Mercedes because everything there is just so secure. They really know their processes well. They're confident. They've got all that success underpinning it. They don't have to overreach for these things. But I think the other interesting thing is that Ferrari, when it's been successful the past few years, it's kind of done it through being overpowered in certain areas, overpowered literally last year. Previously, there was a point where they were very strong on some of the slower tracks because they were sort of very powerful in some areas, but not all of them, whereas Mercedes is just the all-round package. And I guess, Lucy, what Scott said there is he's basically listed every area, hasn't he? And
that's,
that kind of tells you how good you've got to be to get to a level of competing with Mercedes on a weekly basis, certainly.
Exactly. Obviously, Mercedes in recent years have looked like absolute perfection. They've not really put a foot wrong, and when they have, it's been so rare and has been recovered very, very quickly. I'd be interested to think if either of you think that there's anything sort of weak points that might flare up in 2020, especially as focus shifts towards 2021, and whether Ferrari stands a chance of sort of striking back at those moments.
Well, the big question as ever, Scott, is aero, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But also on the engine side as well, because you've got this situation at Mercedes where what they've done brilliantly over the last 6 years is they've given this impression of perfection. They haven't been 100% perfect. There have been errors from the race team. They've had reliability problems. They've had In 2018, the delayed introduction of the first engine upgrade that year. Lewis Hamilton spoke last year about needing less drag and more power for this season. So there have been times where Mercedes has dropped the ball. It's just Ferrari have just dropped the ball more, and they haven't been in a position to pick it up as much as they need to be. So I think the big thing, I think they could drop the ball on the car side, but because we've got stable regs, I don't think that'll be where Mercedes comes up short this year. I think the bit that will be a bigger test, and the biggest test they've faced so far, is having, in theory, Red Bull and Ferrari on their heels from the very beginning, if not ahead of them. And we haven't seen Mercedes under that sort of pressure, certainly not sustained over a title bid. And Ed, as you must have seen in your time covering F1, when a team is under pressure, that's where they have to be. That's where they have to stand up and be accounted for, isn't it?
Yeah, pressure changes things. It means that decisions, it's not as if people are running around in panic, but if you have a little bit of a margin, your decisions are all less critical, shall we say. You know, if you've got a fundamental advantage, it gives you a few tenths, say. If you give away a tenth, it doesn't really matter. But if things are really close, it gets harder and you start trying to overreach. I actually almost feel this is what Ferrari has suffered from for the past few years, in that there were times when they almost tried too hard with things because they were having to really push, and they knew they had to kind of go up that level rather than just letting it come to them. But yeah, Red Bull is an interesting curveball. And if you have, if Mercedes were being pushed by two teams, Ferrari and Red Bull, that could change the equation a little bit. But the thing is, the longer that Mercedes has been robust and effective, the more secure it is. And I think the interesting thing is they do have a bit of a car for all seasons. Mentioned earlier, they're very, very keen on just designing the concept, and everything is about having the best car on the average of the season. And that does mean that outlier circuits they are a bit more vulnerable on, which has been the case in the past. But outlier circuits are outliers, so that's not a major problem. So they do know there'll be weekends where they won't win whatever happens. If there's a real kind of shooting war, so to speak, we probably will see things made harder for Mercedes, because little mistakes will become that would have gone completely unnoticed previously will become big mistakes. And I guess that's what we want to see, isn't it? We want to see a proper battle, because it's when there's a big battle that all these things are laid bare. And we want to see Lewis Hamilton pushed as hard as he can. In fact, Lewis wants to be pushed as hard as he can as well.
Yeah, exactly. It must be so boring to spend every sort of Sunday do I even bother turning up? So yeah, I guess. And do you think that threat from Red Bull will be there this year? We've obviously promised it or thought that it was coming for a very long time. Do you think the evidence at the tail end of last year suggests that it will be a present threat right from Melbourne? Or, I mean, it's hard to say before testing. So
yeah, well, the thing is, we've sort of said this before, there's been a trend where Red Bull have got really strong towards the end of the season. You think, oh yeah, right, this year they'll be there. And they weren't last year. We should say that I think the aero reg changes played a part in that with the front wing. That threw them a bit of a curveball, and it took them, they had a series of upgrades deployed over the races up to and including Austria that they really needed to make those changes to get the car working. So it's really, really hard to say with Red Bull, because we've seen this trend before, but we've also seen them when there hasn't been a rule change not quite making that progression. So I'm interested to see. What I'd like to see from them is not too an aggressive a car. I'd like to look at it and say, yeah, you can see that's just a clear step on the concept from last year. And then hopefully if they do that right, they should be thereabouts. And of course, there's a Honda question as well, Scott.
Yeah, and I think Honda feels vaguely confident that they sort of know roughly how much they need to improve, or they have an idea of how much they need to improve. And whether they will is the big question mark. But the reason Red Bull and Honda, they are especially relevant to the Ferrari situation, because we've seen time and again Ferrari fail to rise to that challenge from Mercedes. And I can think of two or three seasons now where Red Bull just gradually outdevelops them. And instead of challenging for wins, Ferrari slip back and they become they're not even the second best team anymore. They slip back to being the third best team. I think they ended last year behind Red Bull and Honda. And that puts big pressure on Ferrari this year, because it's not even a case of making up that gap to Mercedes. That is obviously the ultimate goal. And if they do that, there's a good chance they'll beat Red Bull anyway. But they've almost got to reclaim their position in the pecking order before they can go on and mount that title bid.
And of course, there's the whole question of the engine side for Ferrari. There was all sorts of talk about it last year. We don't really need to rake over that. But it's clear they need a, a step in terms of, particularly on race day, because it's all very well and good having a car that at times was able to get you pole position. Obviously, Charles Leclerc had more poles than anyone last season, but that's always difficult. And Mercedes, more often than not, even in the races that Ferrari won, Mercedes often had a superior car in race conditions. They just couldn't get the track position from Ferrari. So that's, again, it comes back to this sort of average performance, doesn't it? And that's probably what Ferrari's going to be looking for in this season.
So you don't think there's one like major thing, neither of you could choose like one major thing that Ferrari need to do to finally mount that title bid in 2020?
I think if it's one thing, it's downforce, isn't it? And downforce, ultimately, no matter how important the engines are, et cetera, that's still the number one performance differentiator. So if they can get that, they lacked a little bit on front downforce last season. They took a step with the Singapore upgrade, but they still weren't quite there. And if they can get that downforce, potentially by, I'm interested to see what concept they go with the front wing, because they went down the kind of the unloaded outboard design as we talk about, where the kind of wing drops away towards the end plate. Easier to control, less peak downforce, less peak load. Now, Red Bull and Mercedes made that loaded outboard work well for themselves last year. That was a little bit tricky to do. Some of the midfield teams tried the loaded version and struggled with it. So I'm really interested to see if Ferrari go more towards just maximising what they can get in terms of the load on the front wing, and as a result, can they control the airflow well enough to energise the floor, the barge boards, the rest of the car, because it's obviously all connected. So yeah, it's, in short, it's downforce.
The suggestion last year from Binotto was that they wouldn't be changing that front wing concept, because they felt that actually what they'd proven over the course of the season is that concept itself wasn't what limited their aerodynamic potential. That's certainly what they felt anyway. By that point, this was when he was speaking in December. So you're already well down the design path. So he's either trying to, you know, put people off the scent a little bit, or that is firmly what Ferrari had committed to. So it will be interesting to see. But as much as aero is king in F1, but just for the sake of differentiation, I'm going to say race weekend execution. I think that's the area that even though the car wasn't as good as Mercedes over the season, Ferrari still should have had way more points than they did last year, just because of their own errors, and that comes down to the race team itself, the strategists, the drivers, and to an extent reliability and the work they do back at the factory. It all comes together for race weekend execution, and that was just something that they were weak at. But you're right to say that there are lots of little things, and actually, I know we're playing. I'm enjoying this little game of pass the question, but I'm going to throw it back to you, Lucy, because obviously we see on a weekly basis almost, and hear constantly about this little thing they're working on, this little thing, this has let them down, this has let them down. But just sometimes it is valuable to have that sort of bigger picture. And if you look back at last year in particular, and then throw it forward to this season, could you spot like what exactly was tripping Ferrari up from a distance, or did it just look like they'd go into any given weekend and just something would go wrong?
Yeah, I think probably the latter, and sort of linking back to what Ed said earlier about panicking when you don't have such a clear advantage that it's easier to trip up, and when you do trip up then it seems to be a bigger mistake than it actually is. Just watching from home and just seeing like something that seems to have been handed to them on a plate maybe one weekend, like Bahrain, for example, and just watching that, I remember watching that race and just thinking, oh, this is going to be it, and then, you know, this could be the Mercedes versus Ferrari thing right at the start of the season already. And then it all just sort of unravelling, and it just watching it all unspool like a ball of wool, basically, around them. So yeah, nothing specific, but I just think that there was always something like that happening every weekend, and every weekend where we talked about it all unravelling for Ferrari, it was just, yeah, it was just like a domino effect, I guess. The pieces sort of fell around them.
No, I think you're right there in that there were lots of different reasons, and that's almost a bigger worry, because on the one hand, that means there's not a single recurring problem.
Exactly.
But if there's a single recurring problem rather than just everything, it's at least a little bit easier.
Yeah, you can identify that is where we're going wrong, we can fix that. But if everything is sort of going wrong, then where do you start? And if something different is going wrong every weekend, then how do you know where to focus your efforts on to improving?
And the reliability side of things is a good example of that, because when I spoke to Binotto in, I think it was Mexico last year, this was before Leclerc even had the engine problem in the USA that hurt his Grand Prix there, and then he needed an engine change for Brazil. But he said the problems that they had in Bahrain, you use that as an example, Vettel's problem in Austria, Ed, if you remember, that in qualifying, and then the horrific brace of qualifying problems in Germany, a race where they should have easily been on the front row, lock that out, and they have problems. I think Vettel didn't take part at all, and then Leclerc couldn't take part in the top 10 shootout. And but as I said, they're all different things. So while it comes down to one fundamental problem, which is clearly at some point in the process, we're not validating this well enough, or we're not designing things well enough, you have so many different fires to put out. And that's what Ferrari's been focusing on for 2020. So again, there is some stability in terms of the personnel. Nothing on the surface changes for Ferrari this year. Maybe we will see some aero tweaks, that sort of thing. But it's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that's going to add up to the change that Ferrari needs for 2020.
I find it difficult to imagine Ferrari can win the title in the coming year, because I think if they have a car that's good enough to, are they operating? There's almost just too many areas they need to improve on. It'd be great if they were in the title fight, because the more the merrier. But it just seems like that team's got a bit further to evolve. And you just look at how secure everything is at Mercedes. That's a huge target. You know, Mercedes is, you can make a case for the current Mercedes team being the greatest Grand Prix team there has ever been. They've prevailed through a major rule change in 17, a more minor but significant one in 19. They've had this unprecedented run of six back-to-back championships. Yeah. You know, that's
so
formidable.
Ferrari needs something to unravel there, maybe more than they need to. Maybe that's more like, I don't know which one is more likely, whether they'll fix it or they'll see an unravelling there.
That's a good point. And I think also the whole question of 2021, that's kind of a natural point where you think if there's going to be a sea change in terms of the competitive order, that's the kind of natural place for it to be. But yeah, you never know. I mean, remember when Mercedes were building up, 13, which is the last year of the old rules, Mercedes were quick. They struggled a bit with tyres, particularly in the first half of the season before there was a tyre change. They were a winning team in 13, and actually had won in 12 as well. But it was kind of that process. You've kind of got to take that step from, and each step by step, from winning to occasional winners to more consistent winners to challengers to champions. And they're almost, Ferrari, still not quite at the point where they've been a compelling challenger. Let's move a little bit onto the drivers, Lucy, because let's say Ferrari's strong enough technically, operationally, reliability, all of these things. The focus then will be on the drivers. Now, Charles Leclerc had the edge last year. Do you think he's ready for a title push? And where does Vettel fit into all of this?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most interesting storylines from last year. And I think this is a storyline that will certainly develop this season. I am reevaluating my life a little bit, because I declared at the start of the podcast that my bucket list activity was being on this today. I'm the same age as Charles Leclerc, and he's potentially going to win a world championship. So maybe
he's going to get a world championship before you.
Yeah, well, I think that was always going to happen. I'm not sure. Well, F1 World Championship was on my bucket list, but you know, yeah, reevaluating.
You've got a better chance of being the first female Formula One world champion than he does, though.
That is true. I mean, there is that. Thanks, Scott. That's a small win for me today. I do feel. Yeah, I'm gonna take that. That's.
Get some business cards printed out.
Exactly. Yeah, I will put that in my email signature from now on and put it in my Twitter bio.
That's a good point. Business cards. What century am I living in? Sorry.
This is unravelled in its own way now.
Yeah, surely clear.
The pod was off to such a strong start. Let's bring it back. You were talking about Leclerc. He's brilliant, isn't he?
I think that he is ready to mount a title fight. And yeah, it's the relationship between him and Vettel, and the way that it developed, like over the course of the season. I think in Melbourne there was very much still I think to be an F1 driver you have to know that you're good enough to be there, but I just, at the beginning of the season, it was very much like, looked like he realized how lucky he was to be, and sort of felt that, and quite junior. And then after Bahrain, and certainly as the season developed, and I guess after Austria and the turning point there, I think like his ruthlessness, and you could really see that there was an element in him that was, yeah, had decided that he was going to challenge for the title and feels that he could. So I don't see why that wouldn't continue this year. And I think the relationship between him and Vettel can only go one way. I don't really think that could improve again. And so it'll be interesting to see what Vettel decides to do.
They're not going to go back to being
as pally.
No, they were. They did start the year quite pally, and that. The point that you made about sort of the attitude, I get, or the mentality that Leclerc had at the start of the year is bang on, because I think what changed was suddenly being in the position to win in Bahrain, literally the next time out, because Leclerc was happy to sit back and accept that team order at the end of the Australian Grand Prix.
It's a bit like
Ed, do you remember when I think it was in Malaysia when the Mercs either hit trouble or Ricciardo and Verstappen ended up fighting for the win or second place. I can't remember which one, but basically Verstappen got told sit back and it didn't look like he was going to, but he basically banked it. He was like, okay, I'm going to listen to this team order, but you kind of got the feeling of next time you owe me. And then this, and so bringing it back to 2019 and Ferrari, when Leclerc got that order in Melbourne, he didn't force the issue. But in Bahrain, he was on pole. It was his race to lose. He messed up the start, dropped back on the first lap. And then when he caught Vettel, I think he was within half a lap of being told, basically hold position, he just nailed him on the run down to turn one. And Vettel said, you know, fair game, he was the quicker driver. But it was just that interesting. As soon as he realised the position he was in, he's like, there's a win on the line here, I'm going to take it. And that, from that point onwards, it literally took one race for Leclerc to assert himself over Vettel. I think from that race onwards, he was the number one driver at Ferrari in terms of the performances. It took a little bit of took a little bit too long for him to get the consistency. And Vettel was actually very good over the first third of the season. But now we're coming into this year, I just think with the momentum from last season, the fact that they both had their wrist slaps a couple of times because of their attitude, I can't really see Vettel coming back at Leclerc over the course of a year in terms of performances. And I agree that means the relationship only goes one way as well. The big challenge is going to be not necessarily is one of Ferrari's drivers ready for the title. It's going to be, can they actually put together a title bid when you have two class drivers that might end up at war with each other?
Yeah, and look what happened in Interlagos when Vettel basically bulldozed into Leclerc, and there's no other way to really describe it because that was Vettel's mistake. I think he was just a little bit agitated after being kind of ambushed, as it were, at the first corner when Leclerc passed him up with that slightly unexpected move. I think the whole point about that relationship is Vettel either will feel he has to reassert himself or he just has to kind of accept he's going to be the nice guy number two and sort of go into Kimi Raikkonen mode, which I just don't think is what Vettel wants to do at the moment. So that's going to be really interesting because you're going to have Vettel, a bit like Leclerc was at times last season, looking for opportunities to assert himself. And that can be a useful driving force to have your two drivers going at each other and pushing each other on. But it's a very fine line between that and shooting yourself in the foot.
Exactly. Yeah, it's quite volatile. And I guess it's another thing that Ferrari probably doesn't need when everything else around them isn't as perfect as they want it to be.
Exactly. They might possibly be thinking that if Vettel wants a new Ferrari deal, he might have to be on his best behaviour, should we say. But
yeah,
I suspect Vettel, being a serious competitor, a four-time world champion, and a driver who, despite his mishaps and problems in recent years, there is in there a great Grand Prix driver, but he just can't deliver it significantly enough. I think he'll be thinking, I get my new Ferrari deal by taking charge of the team. And that's something I think you can't... It's down to the team to manage it to a point, but there's a point where the driver has to kind of meet you halfway, shall we say. And I think the heart that you see in a champion will be there determined to take control.
I'm going to take the role of pseudo-interviewer quickly because I've got a question for you, Ed, and then I've got a quick question for the both of you.
Okay.
But for you specifically, Ed, do you think we're now at a point where the question mark is more over whether Vettel's capable of a title bid than Leclerc, and are you surprised that dynamic is that way going into 2020?
It's a legitimate question, but we've not yet seen Leclerc in a title fight at the very, very highest level. We've seen it in junior categories and he's fared very, very well. But I always think of it as a bit of a ladder, that, or maybe a pyramid's a better way of looking at it. Every time you step up, there's a step up in level and intensity. The questions that are asked are harder and harder and harder. And everyone has their sort of breaking points. Elite sport is psychological, as I always bore people saying. So it kind of comes a question of, is there a bit of a breaking point for Leclerc? Does he need to go through that learning process? Inevitably, it's his third F1 season. He will be a better championship contender in his ninth F1 season than in his third. That's just a fact. It's very, very rare you get a driver who's less sort of capable as a guy. You could argue, actually, Vettel's a less compelling title threat now than he was 6 or 7 years ago with Red Bull, funnily enough. But that's unusual. So I think they're both legitimate questions. Let's put it this way. Leclerc is fast enough to be a world champion. And I think he's got he's got that ruthlessness, he's got the drive, he's got the sort of the character profile to be a world champion. But it's just that question of, does he need to build up a little bit of experience? Do you need to have some defeats before you can become a victor? Or, for example, if you look at Lewis Hamilton, his 2008 world title, you know, amazing achievement in his second season, but it wasn't an imperious campaign. And so you almost wonder whether if Leclerc's going to win the title this year, it's inevitably going to be a campaign that's a little bit scruffy and needs a little bit of help, just because of just only his third season. Whereas, you know, if Vettel was to come back to be a title contender, I think he could cope with some of those things, but he can't avoid enough mistakes and be consistent enough to be the established number one in a Ferrari team that's not quite there. So there's big questions on both sides. But put it this way, only one of those two drivers is fighting for their career this season. So if anything, I think the bigger question marks actually hang over Vettel at this stage. But you never know. Leclerc could have a big wobble under pressure. You make a few crucial mistakes and then suddenly your head goes and you have to go through that process. I mean, another one, Jenson Button, when he won the title in 2009, he had a mid-season a struggle. I mean, yes, the Brawn was getting less competitive, but he wasn't getting the best out of it and he was sort of tightening up. So this is what's fascinating, to see how people behave. Only 33 world champions, ultimately, since the world championship started in 1950. So it's a very, very special combination of your skill set, your ruthlessness, your mentality and opportunity that makes a world champion.
Exactly. So which brings me nicely onto my follow-up question, which is for both of you. And I'm going to be cruel and I'm going to direct it to Lucy first. So if it's your money on the table, is it on if Ferrari has a car capable of fighting for the world championship or winning the world championship, do you put your money on Vettel or Leclerc? And a second part, do you change that answer if the Ferrari is dominant or if it's part of a massive fight between Merck and Red Bull?
Oh, good caveat.
That's a very good question. A very good interview. Yes, I think it does change depending on, I think, yeah, I would say, I guess it's easy to say Vettel if they have a dominant car, just because that's the way that history has gone with his titles before. And you look at 2011 in sort of that year, and it was 2011, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, 2011 was dominant. 13 was dominant, obviously. 10 and 12 were a little bit harder.
Weren't so much, but so I think if they have a dominant car, then I would say Vettel. And Leclerc, if it's it's more of a fight between... Yeah, because I guess if you look at like the Verstappen equation, I don't know whether that... Because that's also a very interesting dynamic. So yeah, I'm gonna try and keep it as simple as I can, despite go around the houses a little bit. Leclerc if it's a more complex sort of three-way fight, Vettel if it's a dominant. I think I would like Vettel to win another championship, like in my heart. I think he deserves another one at least, but sensibly, I guess your head, you'd have to say Leclerc.
It's an interesting question, because if the car's dominant enough, that does remove the number of cars that Sebastian Vettel can drive into, which has been a problem over the past year. And it just has been a problem in recent years. I mean, look, last year in Interlagos, we had the mistake when he went off in Canada hitting Verstappen at Silverstone. There is a kind of question about red mist there with Vettel. Red Bull always found that they could kind of manage him. And if they kept his kind of emotions in check, he could be great. And they were very good at doing that from the pit wall. Rocky is race engineer game. Rocker Lam was very, very good at that. And I do wonder whether there's an environmental problem with Ferrari. Slightly different, fractionally different team culture. I'm not going to go down the overexcited Italians stereotype, but there's always slightly different ways of working, etc. And I think it's probably telling that Vettel's not been at his best in a team that's the pressure cooker that Ferrari is, and with all the machinations.
And then
going
I guess
on.
That environment's changing with the arrival of Leclerc as well.
Exactly. It's another ignition point, isn't it?
It's
very, very difficult. I agree with you, Lucy. It'd be great to see Vettel winning another title. I think he's a really... I mean, he's not a Lewis Hamilton level of driver, because Lewis Hamilton can kind of do it in just about all conditions. Vettel, slightly narrower window, but he's not fundamentally the driver he's been over the past few years. Because if you looked at sort of 17, 18, 19, you'd say, well, he's very much an on his day merchant, and he sort of has his moments and of good and moments of bad. So very, very, very difficult. And that's going to be the key dynamic, I think. Where the question doesn't change things is whether he's whether Ferrari's dominant or not, if Ferrari's in the title fight, he's still got to beat Leclerc. Maybe it's a little bit simpler, or rather the equation's got less factors into it if they're dominant, but whatever happens, he's still
it
got
still
to,
comes
still
down to
Leclerc,
that ultimately.
But what you can be sure of is Vettel's going into this season thinking, yeah, from the upgrade, I was back on it. I had the front end I wanted. I had the stable rear. I can get the best out of it. You know, his Suzuka pole, that was tremendous. And that run from Singapore through to the end of the season after that upgrade, the qualifying battle was a bit tighter. And actually, I just know Vettel will be saying, yeah, that was the real me, that back end of the season when they got the car right. And that's the me that they're going to be at the start of the season. So I think there will be a kind of new battle between the pair at the start of the season. So that's... That's my answer to your question. Do you think we should move a little bit on to looking perhaps at the wider story of Ferrari, Scott? Because we've talked a lot about Ferrari's sort of local problems in terms of time over the past few years, but it's a team that's got everything it needs to thrive. It gets a bigger share of revenue than anyone else, even if it doesn't win the championship. But, you know, that race win figure, it's only won 13.5% of races over the past 11 seasons, which obviously isn't good enough for a team of that size. So what do you put that down to, and how do you think we should look at the wider picture? Should we say the post kind of Todd Schumacher era Ferrari? I guess you could put it as the, why is it so often flattered to deceive?
I think if I knew the exact answer, I'd be earning an absolute fortune. I'd be living out in Maranello, and I'd be a special advisor to the race team, and I'd be milking that position for all it's worth. But I think part of the problem is. I don't know if I have sympathy for them for this. Part of it is they have come up against, as you correctly described, Mercedes, one of, if not the greatest Grand Prix teams in history. This is not a fun era to be a slightly like misfiring Ferrari. And I think if you had Mercedes operating at a lower level, Ferrari might have won one or two of the last three titles. So the opposition is better than ever, which is one thing. They don't have Schumacher. Either Vettel was kind of, the whole point was Ferrari didn't sign him to be literally Schumacher 2, but that was kind of the way it was going, wasn't it? The four-time world champion, time he's the one, he's the saviour basically for Ferrari and their hope. So they've lost that kind of central figure that can be trusted, I suppose, to do exactly what is needed on track to get the result, because I can't imagine Schumacher making the quantity of significant errors that Vettel has made over the last two or three seasons, which doesn't help at all. Plus, they've had this such a long period of brilliance with that axis of power at the top, that when it then transitioned into the sort of late noughties, once Schumacher had gone, and then you don't have John Todd, you don't have Ross Brawn, you don't have the people that made it such a success. And it is a problem that Mercedes is going to face, if not this year or next year, in the next two or three years or beyond. If that team sticks around, what happens if or when Toto leaves? What happens if James Allison's not there anymore? What happens if Andy Cowell's not heading up the high-performance powertrains division? How you structure your organization and how you prepare yourself for change is as important as building that right team in the first place. Mercedes is putting an enormous amount of effort into making sure that they don't have that sort of disruption when people move around. And I think Ferrari, you've got the high profile exits, you have the fact that you don't have a Schumacher type person around. I think one of the biggest things has to be that they just haven't managed either the recruitment process properly or the process of promoting people internally, because that's a big thing that Binotto has tried to do the last two or three years, is put the right people in the right places and try and promote from within. Stop trying to look outside the organisation. So maybe that's part of it as well.
I think you hit upon an interesting point there about the kind of the longer term planning and the looking to the future. And if you look back over that period, for example, 2008 was the last time they were in a drivers' championship fight, and they won the constructors. But one of the reasons they didn't start the 2009 season with aerodynamic rule change so strongly was they and McLaren both had this problem. They'd gone all the way down to the last race in Interlagos. They both brought new parts to Interlagos, absolutely going at it tooth and nails, but they hadn't focused enough on the 2009 change, and there were also problems they hadn't really done enough work or started early enough on the KERS side, etc., which held them back a bit. And then if you wind forward a little bit to 2014, again, they were too late on the hybrid engines. They didn't go down because 14 actually had quite big aero rule changes as well, which is often forgotten. But in 13, and this is still Luca de Montezemolo era, he would still sort of sit there in the meetings and say, no, we've got to be better tomorrow. We've got to be better next week. What have we got for the next race? Everything was focused, localized, even long after there was any hope of becoming a title challenger in 13. Whereas where Mercedes has really been strong is that work. You know, they were fiddling around with single cylinder engine test engines really early before they knew what the final form of the 14 engine regs were. Yeah. Just because they took that long-term view, it's like actually taking a little bit of this resource and addressing it to the future is going to be harder. Now, obviously, that's a different era. That was Luca de Montezemolo's Ferrari, and de Montezemolo was extremely valuable for Ferrari for helping pull it out of the doldrums in the 70s. But Formula One's changed a lot, and you know, the lead times, it's like turning a massive heavy cargo ship around or something. It doesn't turn on a sixpence anymore. You can't do a few things and then in 3 days' time suddenly everything's better. It, you know, 3 years' time maybe is your time scale. Now they understand that. It's not Montezemolo Ferrari anymore, and I'm sure Binotto's got a good feeling for that and a good understanding of how long it takes. But then it's a question of how much pressure there is, etc. If I was them, I'd be looking at 2021 as a good opportunity. The ideal for them, obviously, will be to be in title contention this year, and then they need to kind of balance things up. But I think they've, whatever happens, whether they're struggling this year, well, if they're struggling this year, they have to understand the underpinning problems. If they're in a title fight this year, they have to fight that as hard as they can, but not neglect the 21 regs. You know, they're already doing 21, where all the teams are, but you need to gradually move a greater percentage of your technical resource onto that. Everyone needs to do that. So I think that kind of judgment is important, because right now there's a greater chance of them being a title winning team in 21 than in 20. And because they're aero regs and aero, you know, it's not exactly a weakness, but it's a relative weakness compared to, say, you'd probably take the Red Bull aero team and the Mercedes aero team right now over Ferrari by a small amount. So that's the big question, isn't it? And then because it's Ferrari, there's all this pressure, isn't there? And that, again, it comes down to the corporate culture, which Mercedes talk about a lot. So have they got the kind of, has Binotto got the steel to take those decisions and say, actually, I'm gonna sacrifice a little bit of improvement now because that's going to put us better for next year?
I think that Binotto is slightly steelier than people may sort of see on the surface, because he has adopted this sort of friendlier. He's been a lot open with the media. He's been very forward facing. The public have seen what he's about, and he's got this kind of a bit of a jovial attitude to things. Serious when he needs to be, but generally speaking, is very polite, happy to speak about serious issues, and all very well and good. But given that this is, we're talking, you know, an Italian company, Machiavellian politics, etc., etc., you don't rise through the ranks to being the team principal. Given that his background is on the engineering side as well, and he goes way back to, I think Ferrari was like his first job outside of, out, as soon as he finished uni, and goes back to the Ferrari test team back in the early Schumacher days and stuff like that. So he's started from the bottom in an engineering sense, and now he's right at the top. No way do you make that progress within Ferrari, within the way Maranello works. No way do you work your way up unless you're not steely as hell and you've got a little bit of a nasty side to you, or at least able to play the game. So I think he's capable of doing it. It's just whether he deploys it in the right way.
Yeah, he's certainly got a ruthless streak.
Yeah, that I mean, that was in that game of pass the question. That was what I was going to ask. Obviously, Ed, you've seen lots of different eras of Ferrari, and Scott, you have as well. Do you think Binotto can make a difference? Is he the right fit? Because, you know, as Scott alluded to, he's sort of a different choice to the ones that we've seen in recent years for team principal. Do you think he can be the one to make a difference ultimately?
Potentially so. It's just very, very difficult. It's one of those questions you can only really answer once it's happened.
Yeah.
But I think he's, I mean, as Scott said, he's not the kind of, I think there is this image of him, the sort of the spectacled, quiet engineering type, head buried in a laptop, but that's not Binotto. I mean, yes, he is a great engineer. He's a great engineering leader, but he does have the ability to play it tough when he needs to be, and he's an ambitious guy. So I think there is that he's definitely got that edge needed to make it work. It's just a question of whether he's got the supreme competence needed to make it work and balance all those competing political areas. You know, who knows what the pressure will be on the team. And if he's got people on high saying to him, oh, well, why aren't we doing well right now? He needs to be able to say to them, actually, no, don't worry too much about this season. Yeah. You know, yeah, we'll do what we can, but we can't compromise next season for this. Because in racing, everyone wants to win now, don't they? That's what you want to do. But the danger is that in trying to win right now, all you're doing is making yourself not win for a longer period. So it's really tough. Formula One teams and technical side, a very, very complicated beast. But just in general terms, Lucy, how important do you think it is for F1 that Ferrari does actually win a title again?
At some point.
Well, everyone talks about how much everyone loves Ferrari, etc. Yeah. When Formula One does well, when Ferrari does well, you know, is it actually, should sort of neutral Formula One fans be thinking, actually, yeah, it would be good for Ferrari to get a win?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. There's some sort of like great sweeping romance to Ferrari and Formula One, isn't there? And I think that there's more of that than there is with any other team. Sort of Mercedes have lots of fans because they're winning and they're brilliant and they're so efficient at everything that they do, and Red Bull was a bit different and a bit sort of quirky and not really what everybody was used to when they came into F1 and they were successful. But Ferrari is just, yeah, there's just that romance to it, I guess. And you look at Monza, and even when I watch, you know, I've worked lots of F, not as many as you guys, but like on the news desk and that kind of thing, and you sort of get a little bit desensitized, I guess. But then Monza, and when Leclerc won at Monza, even I got goosebumps just to see like how much that meant to everybody that was there. And I remember watching that race and just thinking, oh, this is why I want to do this, because that moment and like being able to experience that moment in any small minute way must just be amazing. I can't imagine what it was like to have been there. But so I think it is really, really important to the longest running team. So of course I think Formula One will do better when Ferrari has won. But then how much of that is, it's such a great story to see them get there as well. So yeah, I guess it's quite complicated, but I think F1 would definitely be poorer without Ferrari.
I think F1 needs Ferrari as much as Ferrari needs F1. Whenever the conversation turns to Ferrari quit threats or is this when Ferrari finally leaves, I can't see it happening. I think as long as F1 exists and it can legitimately call itself the pinnacle of motorsport, Ferrari will be part of it, because it's a big part of the appeal for the brand. It helps sell and position the brand as prestigious and part of this sort of mystical, unattainable level of performance, basically, that only a select few car manufacturers are capable of doing. That's what Ferrari sort of exists to be. It helps put it in an incredible marketing position around the world to a global audience, builds this massive fan base, and then in return, it brings that massive fan base to Grand Prix. And Monza is a brilliant example. It was incredible when Leclerc won last year. His radio sort of shriek over the finish line was just... Yeah, I agree with what you say. You do get goosebumps. You try and you stay neutral from the point of view of it doesn't really matter who wins and who doesn't, but you can't help but enjoy those moments because it's something special. And
well, yeah, as like a Formula One fan, first and foremost, it's really special to see something like that, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're sort of, you can be part of the emotion. I'm a big football fan. I know that, Ed, you don't have a particular football team. I do have my little runarounds in South London that aren't very good, but I have a connection with that club. And when they score, when they win, it gets me. It makes me feel emotional. And Ferrari fans feel that like no other. But even as an F1 fan, you can still get it. It still means something. When Leclerc's on top of the podium at Monza, that's in that single moment, you can see why Ferrari is so important to Formula One. And winning races is one thing and is really valuable to F1. It's been really good that they've at least taken the fight at times to Mercedes the last few years. But it's been so long since that period of domination that I do think the world is ready for a Ferrari F1 title again. It certainly wouldn't be as badly received as the last of the Schumacher titles, for example.
Yeah, there's no question. I think F1 would benefit from that at some stage. I think even if you're a diehard disliker of Ferrari, you wouldn't begrudge them getting one because it's for the wider good, as it were. Should we move on to a few listener questions? As ever, our Twitter account at We Are The Race. You can find us at We Are The Race on various social media outlets. Asked for a few questions, so let's try and pick out a few quick fire answers. We're going for here. So here's one for you, Scott. This is from at DWhitehouse88, who says, who do you think will be the next Ferrari Academy driver to get the push into F1? Schumacher, Eilert, or another? And of course, there's loads of drivers on that scheme. The full list of Ferrari Academy drivers is Giuliano Alesi, Marcus Armstrong, Enzo Fittipaldi, Callum Eilert, Gianluca Petikov, Mick Schumacher, and Robert Schwartzman.
And don't forget the two new FDA members that they've brought in for this year. You have Dino Beganovic from Sweden. Get in. Very happy about that. And Charles Leclerc's brother as well.
Of course, this is my mistake for checking their website to make sure I didn't miss anyone. They've not updated their driver list yet.
We can add their website management of the FDA to the things that Ferrari needs to improve for 2020. It's Mick Schumacher is the answer to that question. He is he's at front of the queue because he's in Formula 2. I know Eilert is as well, and so is people like Alesi, but the power of the Schumacher name, the desire to have him in F1, and the fact that he is a good driver as well. Maybe he isn't the best F2 driver. He might not win the title this year. I wouldn't even say he's necessarily the favourite, but I think he's a decent driver. Ferrari want to see him there, and I'd be surprised if he wasn't driving an Alfa Romeo in 2021.
Yeah, I'd agree with that one. We've got a question from Rohit Subram 30 on Twitter, who says, if Bottas does well this season and earns himself another year at Mercedes and Lewis stays, do you think George Russell should be looking at alternative management / team options? Top-notch driver in the wrong car, so many teams would be interested in getting him. Well, certainly plenty of teams would be interested, Lucy, but what do you think of the idea he might look elsewhere?
Yeah, I probably think it would be wise to maybe keep one eye open to something else. I think there's probably a risk of him getting squeezed out if Bottas gets another contract. We don't know how likely that will be. Obviously looked very unlikely for quite a long time last year and then ended up sort of being a foregone conclusion in the end. But yeah, I think George Russell probably should keep one eye open because I think he's a real talent and he's demonstrated that at Williams with basically absolutely no material to do so, and it would be a shame if he was one of the drivers to be squeezed out by a lack of options and that sort of bottleneck at the top when there are so many names out there, sort of Verstappen being touted for Mercedes, Leclerc not now obviously because of his new contract, but yes, I think he should probably look elsewhere if not moving up the grid by the end of 2020.
Got a question here from at Flatsy1, which is, despite being much maligned and having his place in F1 questioned, Lance Stroll is still the second youngest driver on the grid. Do you see him getting to a much better performance level given time, or are we seeing the extent of what he has to offer? Well, I think Lance Stroll is a very interesting case. I think fundamentally, he's a quick racing driver. We have seen that. Qualifying has been very disappointing for him. And if you watch his onboard laps, there's just lots and lots and lots of little errors. I think there's a little bit of a mental block almost there. There are some question marks about whether that's necessarily the best environment for him, because we often see that this is a general comment about drivers who've got, should we say, infinite backing. They almost, there isn't kind of that level of pressure that they kind of have to get there and nail it. So there are questions about Lance Stroll about just how dedicated he is, because if you're 95% dedicated at the top level of elite sport, then that might as well be 0%. So, but, you know, Lance is still sticking at it. And we have seen moments where things have come through. I think the first thing he needs to do, Checo Perez is quite a good teammate for him in that he's a massively accomplished midfield operator. But he is a driver who, if Stroll can get his qualifying together, he should be able to start matching in qualifying. And we do see some decent Stroll race performance. He's very aggressive on first lap. Sometimes he maybe takes more chances than a Wise, and some other drivers find him a bit frustrating. But there's a driver in there. That's the important thing. He's not a no-hoper who's been put in because his dad leads a consortium that owns the team. But for me, the big question is, does he have the mentality, the desire, the approach to put the absolute nth degree of effort in order to unlock that underlying ability? Because I don't think the underlying ability is the question for him. There's a question here, Lucy, the best director at you, because you were around W Series a lot last year. This is from Agile Harvey on Twitter, which is about Jamie Chadwick, who's been re-signed as Williams development driver. Do you feel she has the potential talent to be the next female in Formula One in the coming years? Of course, the last female driver to enter properly a Grand Prix weekend was Giovanna Amati back
in 92
in the dreadful, dreadful Brabham that, you know, Lewis Hamilton would struggle to qualify that car on most occasions.
Yeah, well, obviously this is my favourite topic to talk about, but I did spend a lot of time in W Series last year. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. The simple answer to this is yes, I think she is, but it's very easy to say that about any female driver that's doing relatively well or is newsworthy at the moment. Yeah, we've said it so many times before. We said it about Susie Wolf, we said it about Simona de Silvestro. So the simple answer is yes, but I think she still has quite a lot to do. And ultimately, as much as I don't want to say this for any way that it could be taken, that we could then, I think there is quite a lot of physical. Like she has to work on her physicality. That's such a hypocritical thing for me to be saying. When I spoke to her last year, she openly admitted that she not had struggled, but that she had been surprised by how much more she needed to do with that. Short term, I think she needs to win W Series this year. And that's really interesting in itself because obviously last year she basically dominated, well, not dominated, but she was there in Hockenheim and it was very apparent that she was going to run away with the season. But I think this year, when the field has had a little bit more time to adapt, it'll be very interesting to see if there is anybody to challenge her or whether it is, you know, she's favourite to win again this year. It'll be interesting to see if she can do that.
A question here for Scott from at AndrewSid93. So we've seen Racing Point recently be negative about the 2021 rules. Do you think Mercedes are the ones complaining using Racing Point? Since they have a close partnership, I mean, before you answer that, I can say Racing Point are definitely being very honest about their position on the rules. Their concerns are, I definitely know, are very much held by the team.
Yeah, so if I'm being asked about whether Racing Point are being honest or spouting off what Mercedes wants, I think I can say with absolute certainty that Racing Point are being very honest in their opinions because they're very against the rules. And I'm pretty sure that's what you said, Ed. So if you adopted that position, I shall adopt that position too. I can't imagine that it's being used as a mouthpiece. There will obviously be some kind of alignment because it's a Mercedes customer team. But that is a team that has its own ambitions and its own intent in its own right. So they will have their own interests at heart. You can't turn... Lawrence Stroll wants to turn Racing Point into the best team in F1. He's putting loads of money into it. There's lots of investment, new factory, etc., etc. And yeah, okay, they don't have a top-line driver lineup at the moment, but they want to build that to become a top-line team. And just if they just went around doing Merck's bidding for them, then they wouldn't be able to achieve that.
Well, we got loads of questions for this podcast, and in fact, some of them we answered on last week's podcast, so you can have a look back there. That was basically a solid podcast of listener questions, but we will try and take listener questions on regularly on this podcast, so feel free to tweet at We Are The Race, or you can tweet at me at EdgeDrawF1 if you have questions you'd like to be addressed. But we do also like to finish the podcast with the newly established Scott Mitchell segment. So I think we need
Scott's people it's called.
Well, you've submitted that as I will take suggestions for what Scott Mitchell's segment should be called. We've got
a logo now, Ed. We've committed to it. It's written down, it's been chiseled into stone, mate.
Where's this the logo? I haven't seen the logo.
If you have a look on Twitter, if you have a look at I've retweeted it. I'm at Scott at SMitchellF1, but Mitchell Adam of Australian fame,
an Australian motorsport journalist of some note,
has done a beautiful, beautiful Photoshop of the Simpsons scene where Bart and Lisa have their show, and Bart has a segment called Bart's People, and my head's been photoshopped onto Bart, and I couldn't be happier with it. I couldn't be happier with it. I've made it my Twitter cover photo. Yeah. That's how happy I am with it.
I think at this point I want to say that my Twitter cover photo is Roberto Moreno in a Eurobrun. Which I think
exactly.
Better.
Which makes me much cooler than you. So
that's not a high bar, to be fair.
No. So I'm delighted. So yeah. So we get on with the late.
Do explain what the segment is and what nonsense questions you're asking people.
Exactly. So the premise of Scott's People is to basically throw a question to the audience. We love having questions from our listeners, but this is to just get a little bit of insight from them. So the way I've started it at the moment is I've just been really curious to see the sort of the more interesting places that an F1 driver has been spotted. And we got a brilliant response the first time we did this, and it was so good that I had too many to read out, and I've since had a few more. So I figured for this week I'm going to stick on the same theme, because I did miss a few. Because he designed the logo, I'm going to give Mitchell Adam the first shout out. He spent some time living in Milton Keynes. He said that he and Daniel Kvyat were stuck on the same not British citizen border queue at Heathrow for so long that their bags weren't at the carousel, and they both had to go to luggage service to work out exactly what had happened. And Mitchell claims he also consoled Kvyat about the fact that he was having to go to Milton Keynes. Mitchell was not a fan of MK. I got a photo sent in from Keith Oswin. Absolutely gorgeous photo.
Another motorsport journalistic luminary and legend.
Exactly. World Rally Championship journalist, I believe. He sent in a pic of... He spotted DC driving a Merc through Monaco, through Casino Square, actually. So he asked DC to stop so he could take a pic. It's a beautiful... That car's lovely. I'm going to give that a retweet, actually. More people need to see that. I got loads... This was a bit concerning, because I kind of feel like you should keep this sort of stuff private. Lots of people have spotted drivers in toilets. Like, and they feel that that is something that they should share with us. That I kind of get it, but at the same time, like, I thought the unwritten rule of a urinal was you don't look around and you don't clock who's in there with you. But anyway, apparently Chris Phillips was stood next to Ivan Capelli in the toilets behind Silverstone pits in 1987, immediately before qualifying.
Near winner of one of my favourite Grand Prix, the 1990 French Grand Prix.
Exactly. A Capelli story has to get a shout out, doesn't it? So that's absolutely nailed on. And I'm going to give... I'll give one for Donna as well. Spotted bosom chums George Russell and Alex Albon catching up in a coffee shop before they started their rookie F1 seasons last year, which I thought was quite cool. Because George and Alex, obviously, they go way back. If you follow either of them on Instagram, they are absolutely... like, it feels like they're inseparable, but maybe that's sort of a slight overstatement. And I'm going to end with one of our own, Sam Smith, our former e-journalist, just purely because I forgot to do it last week and he got a little bit upset. And it's also quite a good one. He saw Alex Caffey sipping a creme de menthe in a jacuzzi at a Joburg hotel in 1999. He says it was a creme de la menthe or some kind of elaborate drink. So I'm going to give Sam the benefit of the doubt there. I saw an F1 driver or team boss having a really leery drink in Monaco. So I'm guessing that's maybe Friday, Thursday night, maybe at a Grand Prix.
Or Sunday night.
Maybe Sunday night. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, so again, another a very good run through of sort of just random places, basically, that people have seen F1 drivers. I would still like to have a few more of those.
I've got one if you'd like it.
Well, I don't trust you, because I don't trust you to have actually seen that driver. Do you know why I don't trust you?
I have a little bit of a bad record of recognising people in general, even people I know. Context, Lucy, is very important for me.
Lucy, but you literally saw a driver at a racetrack. Lucy, have you ever heard of the case of Ed Straw basically completely ignoring Rob Huff?
No.
It was at Goodwood. I was at the members meeting in 2014 or 15. And we were in the paddock. We were having a chat to a few people. Huffy was one of them, but he was sort of on the periphery of the group, and he sort of came over and said, and he looked to Ed, who he knew very well from World Touring Car days, maybe even BTCC.
I first ran into him when he was doing Renault Clio Cup.
This isn't helping you.
No.
This is bad. Stop talking. And so Huffy just turns and goes, "Oh, all right, Ed." And Ed just sort of goes, like, just nods.
I thought
for the benefit of the listener, that was a confused look and a nod.
I thought I was in the way. I spend a lot of my life being in the way of people. So naturally, if people I don't necessarily immediately recognise speak to me, I assume I'm just in the way. So I sort of shuffled out of the way, which I appreciate looks a bit sinister. But I will say in my defence, he was wearing a hat. So
yeah, in fairness, he was wearing a hat. So without that signature Rob Huff head, how on earth can you possibly know who it is?
But you
were apologetic. When I pointed out to you that that's Rob Huff, you were like, oh, I should have known who that was.
Yeah, I just didn't recognise. And context is everything. So to anyone who knows me, does it, if I don't say hello to you, you walk past me, it's not me being rude. I just haven't clocked you. There's a degree of face blindness going on there. But this one was independently corroborated. And I did see sometime a seller driver, Alan Berg, in a pub near Darlington.
Oh, okay. All right, well, I will allow that. And I'm also... I've not thought of this on the spot. I thought of this a while back, and I wasn't entirely sure whether I would commit to it as this week's question, or next week's question, should I say.
This question hasn't been vetted, so I'm a little bit worried.
For Scott's people. I think you'll be fair. One of my favourite Instagram accounts is Non-League Dogs, which is just pictures of dogs that are at non-league football matches.
Brilliant.
So I want to see... It's an extra Scott's people point if it's a dog... But I want to see animals at racetracks. I just like to say,
we're not encouraging people to take dogs to racetracks because normally they're not popular.
Don't let them on the track. That is, Bruno Senna would not approve, I don't think, if a dog turned up to a racetrack. That's what I want to see. I want to see or hear stories of animals at racetracks, preferably dogs.
I once went to a Lewis Hamilton... one of the little press gatherings with sort of five or six journalists at the end of a test day. So it must have been a Spanish there. I can't remember which one, in which Roscoe the dog did attend. And he was sat by Lewis in the press conference. In a little press gathering. It wasn't a press conference. It wasn't as grandiose a press conference. Just sat at a table in the hospitality. So I was able to briefly stroke Roscoe. Because I'm very, exactly. I'm very, very pro dogs. And
you are.
I'd be pro dog. I think dogs should attend many more media sessions.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But that is the magic. That is the magic that is Scott's people. It's bringing these kind of topics that deserve some airtime to the airwaves via podcast, which obviously, as you now know, Ed, I'm a massive fan of.
Well, yes, your podcast listening has boosted. There would be a bonus point for anybody who can supply evidence of a Formula One driver at a non-league football match. That will be the big challenge.
We can invite them on to the podcast if they did that.
Maybe. It depends how good the answer is, because there's probably and there might be some definition of non-league varies as well. But I'd say formally organised non-league. We're getting a little bit off the off the topic there. Should we wrap things up before we go?
We've gone well off piece.
well off piece. There's nothing wrong with doing that. Yeah, so we're certainly encouraging interaction. This podcast will be out every Monday, and we'll do some extra episodes when major news breaks that needs a little bit of immediate delving into. But this podcast now is available on iTunes and various podcast places. So please do subscribe. We very, very much appreciate it. Even give us a review on iTunes if you so choose. Well, if you like it, please give us a review. If you don't like it, don't worry. We'll go without the review. Don't feel obliged to. But yeah, you can interact with us on Twitter at We Are The Race, and on Facebook, Instagram, the usual, and at Scott Mitchell F1 if you want to get involved in what's provisionally titled Scott's People. And for podcast fans, this is just the first of a range of podcasts the race will be producing, so keep an eye out, as over the coming months there will be some additional ones brought into circulation, both related to F1 and other forms of motorsport. So thanks very much to Scott Mitchell and Lucy Mawson, and we should be back next week.